provided both the opportunity and the motivation to use these reserve technologies and to use them more or less continuously. That is what turned foragers into farmers. In summary, warmer climates made village life and farming possible in a few favored regions. Population pressure sometimes made it necessary, and the reserve knowledge accumulated by foragers over many millennia provided the start-up technologies for the first farmers. The geography of early farming was shaped by the happenstance of plate tectonics and the types of plants and animals that had evolved in particular regions. Some plants and animals could be domesticated quite easily. Others could not. Foragers were attracted to regions like the Fertile Crescent, areas that had plants and animals that were ripe for domestication. Foragers surely auditioned many different species as potential domesticates. Among the most attractive plants were those that built up rich stores of nutrition for their seeds, such as fruit trees. Even better were seasonal plants with tubers or fat seeds that stored up nutritional goodies to help humans survive dry periods. Wheat and rice, if harvested at their peak, provided such concentrated sources of nutrition that they were worth the huge effort required to plant, protect, water, harvest, and store them. Animals, too, varied in their usefulness. Zebras were too ornery to be tamed. Lions and tigers were too dangerous and not particularly tasty. But herd animals such as goats, cattle, and horses were easier to control, particularly if humans could stand in for the leader of the herd. If the animals were grass eaters, they could turn grass into meat, milk, fibers, and power, enabling humans to exploit the world's vast grasslands. And their meat was usually tasty and nutritious. But by the time agriculture began to spread, large domesticable herbivores could be found only in Afro-Eurasia. As we have seen, most megafauna, with the partial exception of South American camelids such as llamas, had been driven to extinction in Australasia and the Americas, probably soon after the arrival of humans. This may help explain why agriculture flourished earlier and spread more widely in the Afro-Eurasian world zone than in the other world zones. The early agrarian era. Farming spreads around the world. After appearing in several core zones, farming villages multiplied and spread as farmers honed their skills, learned new ways of increasing production, and took farming into new regions. Major rivers that had laid down fertile alluvial soils over thousands of years, such as the Tigris and Euphrates, the Yellow, Huanghe, and Yangtze rivers in China, and the Indus and Ganges rivers in the Indian subcontinent, lured increasing numbers of farmers. Farming villages appeared in the Fertile Crescent and the Nile Basin perhaps 11,000 years ago, then along the Yangtze and Yellow rivers within a millennium or two. By 6,000 or 7,000 years ago, food crops such as taro were being cultivated in the highlands of Papua New Guinea. Between 5,000 and 4,000 years ago, there were farming villages in the Indus Valley and in West Africa. Farmers also appeared now in the American World Zone, along the Mississippi River, in parts of modern Mexico and Central America, and in the Andes, whose mountains provided diverse environments and a wide range of potential domesticates. There was nothing automatic about the spread of farming from the core regions where it first appeared. For example, it did not spread from the Papua New Guinean highlands into the coastal lowlands, where highland crops such as taro and yams didn't flourish as well. As population pressure drove migrants into new environments, they had to adapt their farming techniques, and sometimes they had to wait until the domesticates had evolved new varieties. From the Fertile Crescent, farming extended into Central Asia, Turkey, and then into the Balkans, Eastern Europe, and Western Europe between 8,000 and 4,000 years ago. As farming spread into the cooler, more forested regions of Europe, with their different soils, growing seasons, and pests, both farmers and their crops had to adapt. In Central and Northern Europe, farmers developed new varieties of grains. In forested regions, they took up shifting or swidden agriculture, a sort of nomadic farming. Swidden farmers burned and cut down trees, then farmed the ashy soil between tree stumps. After a few years, when the soil lost fertility, they moved on. In the Indus Valley, farming flourished 4,000 years ago, receded, then advanced again, starting about 3,000 years ago, along the Indus and the Ganges rivers and into other parts of the Indian subcontinent. In Africa, cattle herders flourished in the Sahara, which was wetter and more productive than today, by 5,000 years ago, and maybe much earlier. By 3,000 years ago, farming was well established in West Africa. From there, it spread into Central and Southern Africa. In the Americas, too, farmers had to adapt to new conditions. For example, distinct varieties of maize evolved in Mesoamerica and along the Mississippi River. As farming communities multiplied, the pace of change accelerated, because farming, and the many changes it brought with it, spread faster than foraging. Why farming increased so rapidly is not immediately obvious, because the farming life could be tough, and that's why foragers survived, often alongside farmers for many millennia. In some regions, such as Siberia and Australia, the disadvantages of farming outweighed the advantages, and foragers flourished until modern times. Nevertheless, in regions suitable for farming, regions that could be made suitable for farming, or regions where rapid population growth pressed hard on available resources, farming communities had many advantages over their foraging neighbors. Even swidden agriculture could support around 20 to 30 people per square kilometer. That was about 100 times the population densities typical of foragers in similar environments. When push came to shove, this meant that farming communities could usually mobilize more people and resources than foragers could. They could swamp them demographically and, if necessary, defeat them militarily. That is why, by perhaps as early as 5,000 years ago, most humans depended on farming, and farming communities and those they supported were beginning to dominate human history. As farmers spread, they transformed their surroundings. Everywhere, farmers cut back forests, built villages, plowed up the land, drove off pests, and dug up weeds. By its very nature, farming required a manipulative attitude to the environment. While foragers normally thought of themselves as embedded within the biosphere, farmers saw the environment as something to be managed, cultivated, exploited, improved, and even conquered. And while collective learning gave farmers the knowledge they needed to manipulate their environments, farming gave them the food and energy flows they needed to multiply and to transform their surroundings over larger and larger areas and with increasing power and virtuosity. Collective learning and new energy flows. These drove the turbulent historical dynamism of the agrarian era, accounting for a disruptive changeability that had not been seen in the Paleolithic. How farming transformed human history. For perhaps 5,000 years after the end of the last ice age, the agrarian era of human history was dominated by farming villages. These were the megalopolises of their era, the most complex, populous, and powerful communities on Earth. As farming spread and populations grew, villages multiplied until they became the communities in which most humans lived. If you were a human in the agrarian era, you were probably a farmer or lived in a community of farmers. Such dense communities were a new phenomenon in human history. By modern standards, farming villages may look simple. But by Paleolithic standards, they were social, political, and cultural juggernauts. They required not just new technologies, but also new social and ethical rules, new ideas about how to live together, how to avoid conflicts, and how to divvy up the community's wealth. If British anthropologist and evolutionary psychologist Robin Dunbar is right that evolution equipped human brains to cope with groups of no more than 150 individuals, it follows that communities much larger than this would need new social technologies to hold them together. During the first half of the agrarian era of human history, most farming villages were independent communities with limited ties to neighboring villages and small enough to be held together through traditional kinship rules. Though exchanges of people, goods, and ideas between villages were increasingly important, there were not yet any states, empires, cities, or armies. The huge complex societies that have dominated the last 5,000 years of human history appeared only after farming had spread far and fast enough to create a critical mass of people, resources, and new technologies. But the roots of agrarian civilizations can be found in the village communities of the early agrarian era. We have already seen that foraging societies contained reserves of potential knowledge of many different kinds, including information about how to manage large groups of people. The potential for increasing social complexity, for large-scale political, economic, and military networks, and for the huge buildings that we find in all agrarian civilizations, was already present in foraging and early farming communities. Göbekli Tepe, in southern Anatolia, offers a spectacular illustration of the intellectual and technological potential lurking within early foraging and farming communities. Göbekli Tepe was occupied first during the era of Natufian villages, and then periodically between 12,000 and 9,000 years ago. It contains 20 stone circles with about 200 beautifully carved stone pillars, some of them well over 5 meters tall and weighing up to 20 tons. Many have strange bas-relief images of clawed or beaked birds or animals. There are no domestic buildings, and curiously, many of the pillars were ritually buried. Archaeologists have also found hints of beer brewing on the site, and that too may hint at ritual activities, as well as bacchanals. This suggests that Göbekli Tepe, like Stonehenge in England or Chaco Canyon in New Mexico, was a ritual center for surrounding communities, an early equivalent, perhaps, of the Olympic Games or the United Nations. It may also have functioned as an observatory. The huge effort that went into building Göbekli Tepe's stone circles suggests the importance of diplomatic and technological links between different communities in an era of rapidly increasing populations. The size of the pillars, the precision and beauty of the carving, and the fact that hundreds of people must have been employed to carve and move the large stone blocks point to a new scale and complexity of social organization. This is surprising because it is likely that those who built the earliest of these structures were not yet even true farmers, but were, like the Natufians, sedentary or affluent foragers. Traditional rules of kinship were challenged as villages and networks of villages grew larger. As early farming villages expanded, built new links with neighbors, and sometimes turned into small towns, traditional rules of kinship and family had to be modified or supplemented with new rules about property, rights, ranking, and power. The traditional social modules of 1 or 200 people had to be linked into larger networks that were inevitably hierarchical. Everywhere, as farming spread, we begin to see new and more hierarchical structures that overlay village communities organized by traditional kinship rules. One way to track relationships and rankings in a village of 1,000 people is to use traditional kinship rules but project them back in time. Here's how it might have worked. If your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents were all descended from the eldest children in each generation, then you could claim the seniority of an elder child for yourself and your whole family. Mechanisms like this made it possible to rank whole families and lineages by seniority. Here we see the beginnings of classes and castes. But talent mattered too. As people lived closer together in large villages, disputes increased over land rights, inheritance, assaults, or damage to property, like the collisions between protons in the contracting clumps of matter from which the stars first formed. But settling disputes in a large village was very different from sorting out a family quarrel. Mediators or judges needed delicacy, tact, intelligence, and experience. And sometimes they needed to be able to impose their will by force. Modern studies of small-scale village societies show how such problems can generate simple forms of leadership, as individuals who are known as particularly generous or forceful, particularly knowledgeable about traditions and the law, particularly pious, or particularly skilled in battle, are granted a modest degree of authority over other villagers. If they are socially and politically adept, they may become big men, leaders known for their generosity and their leadership and organizational skills. Ranks based on lineage or ability laid the foundations for divisions by class and caste. The outlines of imperial power were already prefigured in the feasts and fights of ancient villages. With more people and more exchanges, the machinery of collective learning operated with increasing synergy and power. Many innovations offered incremental improvements to farming in different areas, and some innovations were game changers. Two particularly important innovations were the domestication of large animals and the emergence of large-scale irrigation. Animals were probably domesticated at the same time as the first plants were. Dogs may have even been domesticated in foraging societies and used to help with the hunt, as guards, or even to keep people warm during the winter. But at first, animal domestication was inefficient. Animals were kept penned and fed at considerable cost until they were slaughtered for their meat, hides, bones, and sinews. By 6 or 7 thousand years ago, particularly in regions with wide areas of grasslands that could support large herds of livestock, farmers and herders developed ways of exploiting domesticated animals before they killed them. They began to milk cows, mares, goats, and sheep. They sheared sheep and goats, and they rode horses or hitched them to carts. The archaeologist Andrew Sherritt described these new techniques as the secondary products revolution, because humans had learned to use both the primary products of domesticated animals, the resources they yielded when killed, and their secondary products, the energy and resources they could supply while alive. Until modern times, these powerful technologies were limited to the Afro-Eurasian world zone, because in the Americas, the killing off of many species of megafauna left too few potential animal domesticates. In some regions of Afro-Eurasia, however, such as Central Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa. The gains in productivity from secondary products were so great that entire communities began to live off their livestock, following them from grassland to grassland, living in tents, and returning to a nomadic way of life. We call such people pastoral nomads. Their mobility made pastoral nomads perfect connectors between distant regions, and eventually they would carry ideas, technologies, people, goods, and even diseases right across Afro-Eurasia through the so-called Silk Roads. Large-scale irrigation was equally transformative. In Mesopotamia, population pressure drove more and more farmers from the well-watered highlands of the Fertile Crescent into the arid southern lands at the heart of modern Iraq, through which flowed the region's two great rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. Here, there was so little rainfall that if you wanted to farm, you had to divert water from the rivers. At first, farmers used simple ditches that they dug themselves. Eventually, though, whole communities collaborated to build and maintain elaborate systems of canals and dikes. The largest of these systems demanded thousands of workers and a lot of leadership and coordination. But the payoff was huge in a region whose soils had been enriched for millennia by flooding from the major rivers. Farming advanced by leaps and bounds in regions suitable for irrigation, including North India, China, Southeast Asia, and eventually some regions in the Americas. Irrigation farming supported larger populations, but it also required increasing social cooperation. So it tended to bind farming villages into larger social and political networks. Populations rose fast as farming methods improved and farming spread. It had taken at least 100,000 years for human populations to reach 5 million at the end of the last ice age. By 5,000 years ago, human numbers had quadrupled, rising to about 20 million. By 2,000 years ago, there were 200 million humans, 40 times the number at the end of the last ice age. But population growth was never steady. Everywhere it was interrupted by catastrophes, disease, famine, war, and death, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, flourished in the agrarian era. As mentioned earlier, unlike nomadic camps, villages accumulated waste and attracted vermin, so diseases spread fast. Where new diseases appeared, infections for which people had no immunity, such as smallpox, it was not uncommon for half the population to die. Farmers were also more vulnerable to famine than foragers were, because they relied on so few crops. When food began to run out, weeds, acorns, and tree bark could support people only for so long, and the very young and very old suffered most and died first. As populations grew, villages fought over land, water, and other resources. Their battle summoned the third horseman, war, who could be even more ruinous than disease and famine, and often worked alongside them. Humans had always fought, but in farming societies, more people were involved, and weapons became more lethal as fighters acquired metal spears, chariots, and siege engines. The fourth horseman, death, rode behind the other three. For better or worse, human history had entered a more dynamic era in which change was the one constant. As human communities grew in numbers, size, and complexity, they laid the foundations for the agrarian civilizations that have dominated the past 5,000 years of human history. Chapter 9. Agrarian Civilizations. A Sumerian Poem, translated by S. N. Kramer. In those days, the dwellings of Agada were filled with gold. Its bright shining houses were filled with silver. Into its granaries were brought copper, tin, slabs of lapis lazuli. Its silos bulged. Its quays where the boats docked were all bustle. Its walls reached skyward like a mountain. The gates, like the Tigris emptying its water into the sea, holy Inanna opened its gates. Farming villages and their populations provided most of the human and material resources for the agrarian civilizations that have dominated the past 5,000 years of human history. Look behind the imperial armies and cities, the temples and pyramids, the trade caravans and shipping fleets, the literature and art, the philosophies and religions of agrarian civilizations, and you will find, in the background, often far from the heartlands, thousands of farming communities, as well as a large and even poorer population of vagrants and the dispossessed, many of whom were slaves. People from these underclasses produced most of the grains and meat, many of the linens and silks, and much of the labor, both free and unfree, needed by the great cities. Their produce and labor paid for the causeways and palaces and temples and the silks, wines, and jewelry of the rich, while their men and horses served in the armies. Agrarian civilizations mobilized the human and material wealth and the energy produced by farming villages to build social structures much more awesome and complex than any earlier human communities. Like all living organisms, they mobilized information too, because more information gave them access to more energy and more resources. The appearance of agrarian civilizations represents another threshold of increasing complexity. However, agrarian civilizations were built on foundations created by the evolution of farming communities over several millennia, so we will treat their appearance not as an entirely new threshold, but as a second phase of the threshold that gave us agriculture. To understand the emergence of agrarian civilizations, we will focus not on the histories of particular civilizations, but rather on the questions we have posted throughout our modern origin story. What were the Goldilocks conditions for this new form of complexity? What were the new emergent properties of agrarian civilizations? And what were the flows of energy that sustained those new properties? Surpluses, hierarchies, and a division of labor. Despite famines, diseases, and wars, farming villages multiplied and spread throughout the Holocene because most years they produced more than they needed. They turned energy from sunlight into surplus wealth. This is very different from foraging societies, which stored knowledge but rarely felt any need to store surplus goods, because the food and raw materials they needed were all around them. Why work as a farmer, asked modern foragers in the Kalahari Desert, when there are so many mongongo nuts to eat? In foraging societies, the slow accumulation of knowledge encouraged migration into new environments, rather than the accumulation of material goods. By contrast, farming societies had to store goods, and in large quantities, because many plants and animals were harvested over just a few weeks, but eaten or processed over a year or more. So all farming communities had households, barns, sheds, and fields full of produce waiting to be consumed. As productivity increased, surpluses began to exceed the annual needs of those who produced them. Surplus people, surplus food, surplus goods, and surplus energy represented new forms of wealth, which raised the question, who was going to control and enjoy this wealth? Over time, surplus wealth will be mobilized by small but powerful minorities. And the structures they built to mobilize surplus wealth, often using crude forms of coercion, would form the muscles and sinews of agrarian civilizations. Surplus wealth meant surplus people. As productivity rose, not everyone needed to farm, so new social roles appeared. Many people became vagrants or slaves, but other non-farmers ended up controlling much of society's surplus wealth because they could specialize in useful social roles. They could become full-time priests, or potters, or soldiers, or philosophers, or rulers. Specialists became expert at their limited roles. But the division of labor also created new forms of dependence. As social roles multiplied, human societies, like the first metazoans, became more networked, more differentiated, more interdependent, and more complex. And new linking structures arose, the social equivalents of skeletons, muscles, and nervous systems. Specialists were generally more dependent on the linking structures than farmers, who could usually feed themselves. Archaeologists can track the evolution of a division of labor. In Mesopotamia, pottery provides the classic case study. The earliest Mesopotamian pots are simple and idiosyncratic, and most were probably made in ordinary farming households. But from about 6,000 years ago, we find special workshops with potter's wheels. Potters produced large quantities of standardized bowls, plates, and jugs, and sold them over wide areas. These wares look like the work of full-time professionals who had invested in specialist equipment and long apprenticeships. Specialization encouraged new skills and techniques, so it was both a measure and a driver of technological change. For example, potters needed furnaces to fire their pots, and over time, they built more efficient furnaces that operated at higher temperatures and yielded better finishes. But better furnaces were just what was needed to separate copper, tin, or iron from the ores in which they are embedded, so the metals could be molded, bent, or hammered into household goods, ornaments, and weapons. Coppersmiths, goldsmiths, silversmiths, and blacksmiths all used technologies pioneered by professional potters. As surpluses grew, specializations multiplied. 5,000 years ago, in the southern Mesopotamian city of Uruk, someone compiled a list of 100 different special roles, the standard professions list. It was obviously important and widely known, because similar lists were copied by trainee scribes for many centuries. Organized hierarchically, the list includes kings and courtiers, priests, tax collectors and scribes, silver workers and potters, and even entertainers such as snake charmers. Potters and snake charmers, unlike farmers, did not produce food or leather or fibers, so they fed and clothed themselves and their families by exchanging their products and services for food and other necessities. This is why trade and markets and accounting devices such as coins and writing were as vital to complex societies as arteries and veins are to human bodies. They made it possible to transfer objects and the energy flows they represented from person to person and from group to group. Even the religious specialists we describe as priests had to trade their spiritual services for food and other necessities. Where we find temples, we also find donations and gifts. The degree of specialization was limited by the productivity of agriculture and by the number of extra people that each farmer could feed. In most agrarian civilizations, it took about 10 farmers to support one non-farmer. That is why most people had to farm. Even in the first cities, most people grew crops in their backyards or outside the city walls. But while farmers made up most of the population and provided most of society's resources, specialists became increasingly important as societies became more interdependent. Farmers began to buy trinkets or farm tools and found that they had to deal with peddlers, tax collectors, landlords and overseers. Various different specialists moved goods and resources between towns and cities, produced the coins used in markets, and the metal plows and swords used by farmers and soldiers, kept the accounts, policed the laws, prayed to the gods on everyone's behalf, or organized and ruled others. Specialists provided the struts and bracing for agrarian civilizations. That's why, eventually, they ended up organizing and dominating the rest of society. As specialization increased, so did inequality. The earliest farming communities were reasonably egalitarian, even when they exceeded the ancient community maximum of 150 to 200 people. The Neolithic town of Çatalhöyük in modern-day Turkey flourished 8 to 9,000 years ago, and it shows little variation in the size of domestic dwellings, even though its population may have reached several thousand. Eventually, however, we start finding wealthy minorities, and more of them. To take one random example, there is a 6,000-year-old burial site near Varna on the Black Sea that contains more than 200 tombs. Many of the dead were buried with nothing, or with just a few simple objects. But about 10% of the graves held much more. One contained over 1,000 objects, most of them made of gold, including bracelets, copper axes, and even a penis sheath. This is a very familiar triangle of wealth, with an elite population of about 10% and one person at the very top, while most people lived close to subsistence. When archaeologists find small children buried with great wealth, they can be sure that there are not just hierarchies, but hierarchies that cross generations, because children could not have attained high status on their own. These are signs of aristocracies and castes. Large building projects, such as palaces and pyramids and ziggurats and temples, also tell us that someone had the power to organize the labor of many others. As gradients of power and privilege steepened, new social struts were needed to sustain them. Someone had to police markets, punish pickpockets and thieves, count tax payments, and organize peasants, vagrants, and slaves into the work gangs that built palaces and maintained canals. Complex societies also needed religious specialists to ensure that their gods protected them from disease and provided plenty of rainfall. When these structures failed, everyone was affected. And that is why most of the time, even those at the bottom of the heap usually obeyed their overlords. Anthropologists have studied the emergence of hierarchies in modern small-scale societies, such as those of Melanesia in the Western Pacific. Here, powerful figures known to anthropologists as big men or chiefs built their power on respect and the loyal support of family, allies, and followers. But their power was always precarious. If they failed to distribute enough wealth and privilege to maintain the loyalty of their followers, they could swiftly lose their power, their wealth, and sometimes their lives. Why follow someone who cannot coerce you and from whom you receive no benefits? Eventually, in larger societies, there appeared much more powerful leaders. They ruled over hundreds of thousands of people and controlled such huge flows of wealth that they and their allies could buy the muscle needed to impose their will by force when necessary. Indeed, the use of force to extract labor or produce or wealth became ubiquitous in agrarian civilizations. That is why slavery and forced labor were common in agrarian civilizations. And the methods used to extract wealth and labor from peasants show that their condition was often little better than that of slaves. A wonderful document from Egypt, written late in the second millennium BCE, gives some insight into the methods routinely used to make peasants surrender surplus resources. The author, a scribe, explains why it is good to be a scribe. Think of the hard labor of a peasant, the long hours spent working the fields in the heat and cold, or looking after livestock, or mending farming equipment and buildings. And then imagine what can happen when the tax collectors turn up with armed bodyguards. One says to the peasant, "Give grain." "There is none," he says. He is beaten savagely. He is bound, thrown in the well, submerged head down. His wife is bound in his presence. His children are in fetters. His neighbors abandon them and flee. There is surely some caricature here, but we have plenty of evidence that extortionate methods were used in all agrarian civilizations to maintain order and to extract labor and resources from the majority of the population. We generally refer to power structures capable of exerting this sort of control over extensive areas as states. States emerged in societies that were populous and wealthy enough to have towns and cities, as well as large numbers of farming villages and plenty of surplus labor that could staff and pay for armies and bureaucracies. From towns to cities and rulers. Mobilization and a new trophic level. As populations and surpluses grew, so did the size of the largest human communities. And communities as well as people began to specialize. Some villages grew and acquired new roles because they were near trade routes, controlled strategic river crossings, held markets that attracted buyers and sellers from other villages, or were near important religious sites. Çatalhöyük in southern Anatolia was surrounded by good farming land, but it also had obsidian, the hard volcanic glass used to make the finest and sharpest Neolithic blades. Its inhabitants may have traded obsidian as far as Mesopotamia. Jericho, one of the oldest sites of continuous settlement anywhere in the world, was first settled in Natufian times because it had a well that never ran dry. By 9,000 years ago, Jericho had evolved into a town of perhaps 3,000 people. As towns grew, some offered new services, jobs, and goods. More people were lured to them, and over time they acquired power over the villages and towns in their hinterlands. By 5,000 years ago, some large towns had turned into cities, huge, diverse communities, supported by surrounding towns and villages, and with large concentrations of specialists. The diversity of skills, jobs, goods, and people found in cities explains why they became technological, commercial, and political dynamos in all agrarian civilizations, and why they sucked people in from the surrounding countryside. The appearance of cities and states marks a fundamental transformation in human societies. Traditional states were very different from modern states. Above all, they lacked the communication technologies and bureaucracies that allow modern states to reach into the lives of all their citizens. Traditional rulers could exert immense force locally, but it could take weeks or months to send an order to outlying provinces and as much time again to learn the outcome. So away from the major population centers, the power of rulers depended on loose, hierarchical networks of local lords, who often governed their own territories as more or less independent fiefdoms. Nevertheless, the first states were a new phenomenon in human history. They all assumed the right to mobilize wealth from farming communities, towns, and cities in return for some degree of protection. As the English political theorist Thomas Hobbes wrote in Leviathan, 1651, "The right to distribute resources belongeth in all kinds of commonwealth to the sovereign power. For where there is no commonwealth, there is a perpetual war of every man against his neighbor." Traditional elites owed their power, in part, to the intrinsic weakness and isolation of traditional farming communities. As Karl Marx noted, peasants had no more unity than potatoes in a sack. That made them vulnerable to predation, because even weak rulers could use small numbers of enforcers to impose their will, village by village. This uneven balance of power explains why, for many thousands of years, small groups of rulers and officials successfully dominated much larger populations of farmers. The history of the first cities, the first states, and the first agrarian civilizations is best known in Sumer, in southern Mesopotamia. Here, a large cluster of cities emerged quite rapidly, about 5,500 years ago. The southern Mesopotamian city of Uruk is often described as the first city in human history. It was a port on the Euphrates River. Like most Mesopotamian cities, it depended on complex, well-managed irrigation systems fed by the major rivers. But it also bordered the swamps of the southern river delta. Indeed, it may have grown in a period of drying climates, which forced people from outlying villages to migrate into the cities with their well-maintained irrigation systems. 5,500 years ago, Uruk had a population of 10,000 people, living on opposite banks of the river Euphrates. 200 years after that, it probably had as many as 50,000 inhabitants, living in an area of about 2.5 square kilometers. At some point, the river Euphrates shifted its course and began to run around the edge of the city. A city of 50,000 people may not sound impressive today, but in its time, Uruk was a monster, perhaps the largest settled community that had ever existed in human history. It had two big temple complexes. That means there must have been powerful priests or kings who could mobilize the labor of thousands of people, many of them slaves. Uruk had workshops that made objects of great beauty, and it had storehouses for grain and precious goods. Accounts from a few hundred years later give us some idea of what you might have seen if you had visited Uruk when it was the capital city of King Gilgamesh, the hero of the first written epic. There would have been large temple complexes and royal palaces. You would have seen gardens and narrow streets and alleyways with workshops, inns, and shrines. The city was surrounded by a wall of burned brick, and canals led to the harbor and nearby farmlands. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, the king says, "One third of the whole is city, one third is garden, and one third is field, with the precinct of the goddess Ishtar." Archaeologists have found Uruk-style goods as far afield as Anatolia and Egypt, which suggests that Uruk's merchants were trading over a large area. Sometime around 5,000 years ago, the first writing appeared in Uruk, on clay tablets in the temples of Ayana. More complexity meant more information, and writing was the new technology that allowed the wealthy and powerful to keep track of the increasing resources and energy flows at their disposal. Almost all the earliest writing in Mesopotamia consists of inventories. So many cows and bulls, so many sheep, so many bales of linen, so many slaves. They tell us that we are now in a world of rapidly increasing inequality, in which networks of rulers, aristocrats, and officials control flows of information and power that enable them to mobilize the energy and produce of large numbers of slaves, farmers, and artisans. A wonderful artifact known as the Standard of Ur, exhibited in reconstructed form in the British Museum, gives us a vivid glimpse into the cities of southern Mesopotamia almost 5,000 years ago. The Standard of Ur is a box-like object that may have been part of a musical instrument or may have been carried in parades. Its actual function is uncertain. On its sides are mosaic images made of shells from the Persian Gulf, lapis lazuli from Afghanistan, and red stones from India. One side shows the city of Ur at peace. A king-like figure and wealthy lords sit at a banquet being serenaded by a singer with a lyre. The king and nobles are larger than the servants, an artistic convention that highlights their rank and importance. Lower panels show goods and livestock being brought to the city, perhaps for the feast. The surpluses produced by farmers are being pumped upward to be consumed by elite groups. The other side of the standard shows Ur at war and illustrates some of the forces that maintain these steep gradients of wealth and power. At the top is a figure who is larger than all the others and is surely a king. Below, we see troops, apparently in official uniforms, and military leaders riding chariots pulled by donkeys. Some seem to trample enemy soldiers, while others drag naked captives with clearly visible wounds. The cities of southern Mesopotamia 5,000 years ago represent the sort of society that would dominate the history of the next few thousand years. Expensive, well-equipped armies allowed rulers and the elites that supported them to repel foreign enemies and maintain the gradients of power and wealth on which their own power and wealth depended. Like the proton pumps that maintain an energy gradient across cell membranes, soldiers and the armed retinues of nobles maintained gradients of persuasion and coercion that pumped wealth from villages to towns to cities and governments. Images of these power hierarchies, with magnificently dressed kings and overlords menacing their enemies and subjects, appear in all agrarian civilizations. Viewed ecologically, states and their rulers represent a new step in the food chain, a new trophic level. We've seen how energy from sunlight enters the biosphere through photosynthesis and travels from plants to herbivores to carnivores. And we have seen how most of that energy gets wasted at each trophic level in a sort of garbage tax. That leaves much less energy to support the higher levels, which is why there are fewer lions than antelopes. Agriculture increased the resources available to humans, so states could add one more trophic level at the top of the hierarchy. Rulers and nobles and officials began to squeeze wealth from the labor and produce of peasants, who in turn got their energy and food from farming. States used these new flows of labor, produce and energy to pay for the armies, bureaucracies, palaces and goods that made them powerful and wealthy. Thinking about such processes in ecological terms reminds us that wealth never really consists of things. It consists of control over the energy flows that make, move, mine and transform things. Wealth is a sort of compressed sunlight, just as matter is really congealed energy. Mobilizing this compressed energy from the rest of the population, along with the flows of resources that it made possible, became the fundamental task for rulers and governments, and that task would shape all aspects of the evolution and history of agrarian civilizations. Indeed, mobilization was more central to the work of traditional states than it is to that of modern states. Traditional rulers did not need to concern themselves too much with the education, health, or day-to-day lives of most of their subjects, because peasants could generally support themselves. In fact, many peasants continued to live in independent villages, well beyond the reach of states and empires. So where states did rule over peasants, their main task was to extract resources from them. And over time, rulers, officials, and nobles became increasingly skillful at the task. If they needed more resources to build palaces or roads, recruit new legions of soldiers, or pay for their own luxury goods, few traditional rulers opted for the modern strategy of investing in productivity-raising innovations. They were conservative technologically, because change was so slow that innovations rarely yielded significant returns within a human lifetime, and often disrupted existing flows of wealth. Rulers might invest in new weaponry or build roads, but for the most part, the challenge was to increase available resources with existing technologies through traditional forms of mobilization. To increase their wealth and power, traditional rulers had three main options. The most foresighted encouraged peasants to plow up unfarmed land and urged merchants to seek out new commodities. But many sought more rapid gains by using two other riskier and more coercive strategies. They could press harder on their own populations at the risk of popular uprisings or economic breakdown. Or they could gamble on taking wealth from neighboring states by sending in their armies. This was dangerous, but it often worked. And that is why most traditional elites were warlike. That also explains why, when rulers had statues made in their honor, they usually posed wearing armor and carrying weapons. This was, after all, a world in which resources were mobilized primarily through the threat of coercion, and in which the ability to mobilize and inflict violence was widely admired. If you were a king, taking resources from your neighbors was one of the most important ways of growing your economy. And if you succeeded, think Alexander the Great, you would probably be admired no matter how much misery you caused. The central role of mobilization is apparent from the manuals of statecraft that many traditional rulers produced. One of the richest examples is an Indian manual of statecraft, the Arthashastra. It was probably written slightly less than 2,000 years ago, but it assembled the accumulated experience of many earlier manuals. Powerful states had emerged in the north of the Indian subcontinent as early as 4,200 years ago, along the Indus. But the so-called Indus civilization collapsed about 400 years later. 800 years after that, new states appeared, now along the Ganges River too, as iron technologies allowed the clearing of forests, so agriculture expanded and populations boomed. By 500 BCE, powerful cities and states were appearing, some of which had conquered smaller city-states. Within the next 200 years, the huge kingdom of Magadha appeared, with a capital, Pataliputra, near modern Patna. At its height, Pataliputra may have had 1 million people, making it as large as Imperial Rome. Magadha was conquered by the Mauryan dynasty around 320 BCE, in the aftermath of Alexander the Great's unsuccessful invasion of North India in 327 BCE. It has often been claimed that Kautilya, the author of the Arthashastra, was the prime minister of the first Mauryan emperor, Chandragupta Maurya, who ruled from 327